Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast.
We're going to get you all riled up.
Catholics allowed.
I started to say podcast, then I said broadcast, and it became
a podcast.
Yeah. So I was trying to formulate my other thing I was going to say in my head, which I can't multitask. Proof, folks, I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
Brad Brushwood.
Man, me without my cattle prod.
And the victim of said cattle prod, Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Don't do that, Brian. It's not cool.
I'm like, okay, switch to the four shot. Zap.
Backseat driving.
Now your turn to get me. Hey, while we're doing this, we're watching the Mars InSight landing with some very hilarious closed captioning. But so right now, NASA trying to land a probe on Mars.
Yeah, are they doing anything live with that 15-minute lag with curse you light speed? I mean, what's there to do outside of just sort of watch?
Well, yeah, they get data back. They're finding out what's happening with there. You know, in the remote situation, there could be. I mean, now it's kind of like I don't really know what you could do at this point when you're going through entry.
It does occur to me, like, let's say now they got something that, like, oh, the so-and-so gizmo component has seized up, and that'll be a problem in 30 minutes after it's landed or whatever. So it's like, well, let's reboot it now. Or
yeah, I don't know. Yeah, at this point they do that, but you know, as you point out, rebooting is one of the things they can do, other stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, this is a mission profile that was planned a long time ago, and now they're gonna just sort of like, let's see what happens. So we'll see what happens. So I guess other people are kind of following us a little more closely while I try to interact with you guys.
Yeah.
And we'll see. There was some clapping.
It looks like the parachute
has deployed.
Deployed, yeah.
I love that we're observing people observing a piece of equipment on the other side of the solar system.
Exactly. This is why people listen to this podcast, so we can watch another thing and then tell you about the thing that happened a while ago.
Justin, we are receiving confirmation live reports. People in wizard robes are clapping. We think this is a good sign for the harvest to come. Back to you, Justin.
Thank you, Brian. We're actually getting further notice that these wizard robes are indeed creased expertly. So please add that to your mental Rolodex. Back to you, well, Brian.
It's funny, Justin, because you point out, like, oh, here we are describing a thing that we could already watch. Like, yeah, you just sort of just trashed all sports announcing.
Fair point. So get some, Al Michaels.
I guess it's a little bit like getting your sports information only by watching the stands and not the actual game.
All right, so just so we know what this is, a probe we talked about last week. Mm-hmm. It is landing. It is going to give us heretofore unseen data on the soil of Mars, the composition of Mars. We've never really dug into it and kind of understood sort of what was under the hood, so to speak. But we are not going to see a lot of that immediately. Is that the case?
Yeah, because like according to the profile, the thing's going to land. Then they're going to go through a long systems check, make sure everything is fine. And then one of the things they're going to check is they're going to check the camera. But the way they're going to check the camera, they just want to make sure the camera can take a photo and send it. But they're going to leave the lens cap on the camera. So we'll get, you know, a there will be a photo taken on Mars.
Yeah.
Is there any reason for doing that?
Well, I mean, if what you want to do is verify, I mean, the only thing that's unfortunate is that this is any kind of media event and that somebody hasn't thought through, you know, hey, it does. This is one thing SpaceX has been very, very good about is understanding that. That there is room for some artistry so that people can really, to use a Martian word, grok what what is happening and the significance of it. And whereas by the numbers, you know, science people be science, and, you know, whether you take a picture today or tomorrow, and, you know, most likely on the checklist, there's a lot of other things you should do before you take the lens cap off. So in that regard, you know, it's a perfectly fine decision. It's just an unfortunate one in an age of media touchdown. Events that that is happening.
Hold on, yeah. Touchdown is on the surface of Mars.
There we go. It's there. We're watching a we're watching Gryffindor hug each other. They won the Hogwarts Cup.
Back to your point, Brian. Because now comes this. Yeah, we the zero flip to a one on somebody's computer screen.
Yeah. Well, and so now, you know, now I guess I don't know. I guess. If it's all in one piece and that's the important thing, then great. And now we'll find out, you know, just how well everything works. It'll be the slow rollout. Everyone's already hitting the bar. They're gonna beat up Hufflepuff now.
I don't know the exact engineering or the politics or what's going on behind there, but I would have loved, like, yeah, let's put a cheap GoPro on there and send a signal back just so the viewers at home get to see, hey, look, it just landed kind of thing. Because, like, as you're saying, it's like, it's this is great, but, you know, you want to capture the hearts and minds. Like, NASA doesn't have anything like, I don't know, boosters landing, you know, or space, you know, spacecraft carrying cars to show right now, you know.
So. And even compared to the other lander that happened a few years ago, they did at least have, like, a picture, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of capped off the event, like, is that's pretty much when it's you know, that's your big finale, is a picture getting taken on Mars, and then it's like, all right, you don't need to go home, but you can't stay here, and the science.
Yeah, and that's you know, I'm sure that was discussed, but I wish that was the case, because then we get to see, like, we get to feel like we're there, and it's not just a bunch of, you know, spreadsheets. That's I'm excited, right?
Yeah, no, I'm so excited. I'm going to express it in mathematical form and send it to the appropriate NASA excitement receptacle. But here's my question. When was this launched? Because this is always one of the things that happens kind of as the second day conversation whenever one of these monumental, and let me not take away how insane of a feat this is to pull mm-hmm. off the kind of money, precision, and preparation that goes into this is mind-boggling. But one of the things that normally happens is that, you know, tomorrow or the next day, we get the, like, oh, by the way, the, like, guts on this insane thing was, you know, something that is less powerful than a Samsung phone that you're gonna, like, give to your 5-year-old because you don't want him to have the better one. Like, because they take so long from approval process to launching. And I guess so it was May 5th, 2018 that it was launched. But do we know what the guts on this thing are? Or?
I don't know. But remember, too, is that it has to be the big limitation there is, of course, power, is how much power you can supply to the thing. And so it's a thing that has to be able to use whatever they put solar on these things so it can recharge itself to a degree. But, like, I don't know the specifics of that.
Yeah.
So, don't have an intelligent answer.
That's sure. Fine. Well, you know, we know that these people are very excited, and I'm excited for them. So let's continue to dig on Mars. When might we see a picture or something like that?
I think it's gonna be several days, you know, before I think they do their each one of the systems checks, etc. You know, to make sure everything's sort of doing what it's supposed to be doing, and then finally, I remember seeing some timeline of that, but it was like, oh, so we're gonna, you know, I'm gonna go to a room and have somebody tell me it landed, and be like, oh, okay, like the imaginary space program.
Like, well, I mean, it's like a radio drama.
The lander begins its day-to-day science activities 30 days into the mission.
Holy cow! So
we will be into 2019 by the time that we get the actual activities of the lander. Yeah.
That's because, like, part of what it has to do is, like, it's using instruments. It's trying to, like, put onto the surface to, like, measure seismic to drill in. And you've got several meters around it, right? This isn't a stationary thing. They've got to figure out, do we go into this spot?
Look at this.
We do here.
They got something. We got some kind of image of a horizon. And this would be your version of the GoPro, like at least something to look at.
The test signal.
Wow.
Oh, we did get, there's the dust over there.
Yeah, look at that. It looks like...
Yeah, they probably shouldn't have taken off that lens cap. But they got some late-breaking advice from a podcast host, and, well, here we are.
Yeah. Well, you can see that's like why it's covered in dust, because I think it's a transparent lens cap, apparently.
Oh, gotcha. Clever. Oh, I thought they... Yeah, there's some NASA employee named Lenny nervously fingering the lens cap that he forgot to put on back in
May. Yeah, no, what we're looking at, it looks like... It's you see what we assume is, you know, a wide angle and like just tons and tons and tons of dirt all over the thing because it's, you know, bladed. But that's the cap that comes removed. So
there we go. Okay. So it was a transparent lens cap. And that's what the image that I'm sure people who are excited about this have probably possibly even seen by the time that they listen to us talking about. That is what it is. It a big dust flecked picture of. A wide angle picture of the Martian landscape.
Very, very cool. But well, we have that.
There we go. That was the big hurrah. We're on Mars, baby.
Very cool, exciting, and is talking about how challenging these things are. The success rate of probes to Mars has not been very high at all. We're one of the few ones to like reliably, meaning like more chance of success than not. Like the Russians have kept everything they've tried to send to Mars has just failed, fueling conspiracy theories. So
I remember also, one of the most epic failures boiled down to somebody used inches while they were supposed to use centimeters back in the 90s.
Yep. That's been, you know, just even the launch point and then trying to get there. So it's Mars is hard.
Wait a minute. Is there a conspiracy that Russia has gotten to Mars and they're just lying about it?
Oh, I figured the conspiracy would be that the U.S. is goaltending, is sort of batting them out.
They were slapping them out of the sky.
Yeah. They're like, oh, did you lose that one too? Oh, man. Oh, about that. Man.
They stopped, right?
I guess that's the convenience of having a secret moon base since we got there 50 years ago.
I think you guys would know how to get to a red planet, just saying, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of sticks out like a sore thumb.
Yeah. Well, we'll change the topic here, gentlemen.
All right.
This was a very interesting piece. I sent it to you guys with a note like, let's talk about this. And there is a journal that is being put out. It's going to start, and it's called the Journal of Controversial Ideas. And the premise behind this is that, hey, there are some ideas or some topics in science and the social sciences and elsewhere that might be too controversial for someone to publish under their regular name, meaning that it could cost reputational, you know, disadvantages, et cetera, and that maybe we need to have a forum for allowing people to, you know, publish anonymously in a journal that's got, you know, some more rigor than just, I put it up on a Tumblr, but still allows for anonymous publishing.
This is interesting because they would have to vet the source, because you don't want to just open anyone up to it.
You don't have to vet the source. I think you just have to vet the research.
The data.
Yeah, I guess so. But then the people who are making those editorial decisions, they're putting their names on the line, right? Or are they anonymous as well?
Oh, I think that, you know, you could take some stuff. You know, I think the idea is that I don't know if the journal authors plan to know, but I think that the journal can say, like, hey, listen, read the paper, and it's kind of because there's been a lot of controversy over this, and kind of the argument is like, hey, let's just judge the data as you should with any other journal. You know, you should judge the data. You can say, like, you know, we can evaluate, but there is a reproducibility crisis in science. That is a big problem. We're finding out so many papers, so many big papers cannot be reproduced. You know, psychology was rampant. This, we're finding other issues.
And I don't even think it's an understatement to call it a crisis. I think that is a legit, huge problem.
Yeah. So and part of this comes from the fact that if you're a big, huge university that can do a big comprehensive study, you know, chances are that somebody's going to be able to reproduce it are limited. So if you have weak signal, but you believe that you found it, you know, and that's a big problem. We found some nutrition studies from major universities, et cetera. So there's already a crisis there. But here, this is trying to address saying if you wanted to talk about controversial topics. So, you know, let's. You know, it's one of these things like, man, I can think of a number of controversial topics, but I'm almost.
No, I think yeah. It really is interesting. Like, you know, a moral case for human cloning and genetic engineering, you know, an economic case of how it would be better for not only mankind, but possibly the planet to learn to adapt to climate change rather than stop it. You know,
although you're avoiding the third rail, like a big way.
Which one is that?
Gender, race,
those issues? Yeah. Demographic studies. Wow. That would be hot button stuff.
Let's kind of take the kernel of anonymized information just writ large, right? Because we do have a relationship with anonymized information in popular culture. We oftentimes think that it is something that is more, it reveals a deeper truth. You know, we even saw, you know, the trend a couple years ago of social networks trying to be built on anonymized data that tends to have a tricky relationship once you start to get it going. But anonymous sources happen in newspapers all the time. The question is, when in all those cases, you're trying to defeat something that squashes certain conversations and debates. In the case of anonymous sources in newspapers and magazines, these people have jobs that they need to protect. And so getting valuable information in a specific scenario is something that we in generally understand is necessary for truth to be fully known, specifically when it's in high pressure situations. What I would say with this is kind of a repudiation of the academic system being the end all be all of not only scientific research, but also that the dissemination of it, that, you know, academic journals are very often tied to where certain reports are done and how they are completed. Academic researchers, you know, are often tied to fundraising. If you do a big splashy thing, then you are going to get more of it. If you do not produce those kinds of results, then you will get less of it, which I think we can probably all agree if it's not the only way to do it. It's certainly an imperfect way to do it, and it is rife for possible fraud.
It does seem to me also that this idea for a journal doing this is inherently scientific, because if we believe that the ideas are what matters, then, you know, the reputation, the baggage, the history of the person who writes those ideas should theoretically be irrelevant. And so it's a way to double blind any biases that people might have for who is saying it, and this guy is in the pocket of big oil, or he voted for this person. I don't know. I'm trying to think of any downside about this. I mean, outside of the vague megrims about dangerous ideas, you know, taking hold. But that doesn't seem to ring true here.
Well, I will. Let me pull up the. An article. There's been a lot of criticism of this, and, you know, criticism sort of stems from one of the ideas. Let me find this delightful quote, which let me get you.
And by the way, I do want to recognize one of our best listeners, viewers, and supporters, Tally Zarel, who is currently doing academically sponsored research on, you know, brain chemistry. So she's, you know, it issued me a settle down. I'm not here to say that all academic research is suspect. I think that there is a tremendous, tremendous amount of good that is driven forward by it. But from my, you know, albeit imperfect view of it, I don't think that it should be the only place in which credence is given to good scientific breakthrough.
Yeah, you're not going to find a more pro-science crowd than I think here. But, you know, the process, talking about how the process gets messy,
this is only peripherally related, an equally nutty and I think possibly important idea. I remember shortly before his passing, Michael Crichton was calling for double-blinding funding so that mm-hmm. the people executing any study could not know who was writing their checks and therefore could not, in a million little unconscious ways, bias their results.
So there was a response in the conversation by Haxine Dang and Joshua Hapgood Coot for this, and there's been others. And I found their response problematic for some reason. They're very much against this idea, but they make it for the reader of the paper, attaching authors to papers is important to help them decide how seriously to take the results. So they're saying like, well, how are we going to use the argument from authority when evaluating something that's in a journal? Well, theoretically, if it's in a journal, it's passed a certain amount of credibility. I would argue beyond that, you should not be giving too much weight to whose name is attached to the paper, because we found numerous examples of where that's of limited value, you know? So if you're saying, if you trust the journal to say, yeah, we put these names in here because they have the credibility, fine. But if you're giving, you know, because that's one of the problems is we look for Ivy League universities. We put a lot of weight there. And I would say that those places are better at filtering out garbage than smaller ones, but there's a lot of great stuff that doesn't get enough attention because all people do is look for the cover. So it started from, that was one of the things I said, to fundamentally have an issue. They're right. Holding authors responsible functions as part of academic quality control. If researchers know that producing bad work has social and career consequences, this incentivizes more careful and diligent work. Similarly, holding authors
morally
responsible motivates a healthy degree of caution on topics which might cause real harm. Topics that might cause real harm.
That's actually a pretty good point, because when somebody begins their academic career, you know, they're looking, hoping to, you know, hopefully be a name for the history books. And if it's truly anonymized, then all of a sudden you throw a bunch of different scattershot things out there and you lean into, you claim credit for the ones that happen to be right and stick. And ignore all the rest. And I see that. Also,
yes, to that point. But their point is that it's an academic quality control. The idea is if you have to put your name on it, it's quality control. And they go on to say that, like, you know, incentivize careful and diligent work. I would, again, if you threshold of the paper, but the idea is it also means you're subject susceptible to peer pressure. And the idea of topics that might cause real harm, what do they mean by a topic that causes harm?
Well, like, for example, in the chat, they're pointing out that even though it was fully discredited, the study, incorrect as it was, that vaccines cause autism has done a tremendous amount of very real harm. And I mean, that's actually a really good counterpoint case for this. If
in my email I sent to you about this article, I pointed out the problem with that counterpoint of the vaccine. The problem was the Wakefield studies. If you're taking medical research very serious, this comprehensive study, you're going to need access to the data. If they put that into, if that had existed, if Andrew Wakefield's study existed only in an anonymous journal, it never would have done the damage that it did, because people would go like, well, we need to test this. We need to study this. And yeah, you could put spurious stuff. That existed in the system we had. It existed in the system we had. It came out there. Had it been anonymously published or whatever, nobody would have paid any attention, because when you're talking about a large medical study or theoretical study that he did, and the problem now has happened in the vaccine research. If you say, hey, I'm super pro-vaccine, but we think that we need to adjust this. This could be causing problems. You get shut down out of fear, because there's this anti-vaccine camp, which has just done tremendous damage. And now people are so gun shy to do anything that could say, well, maybe we need to do this or do this here, and being afraid of, it's like climate science. You can say, hey, I believe this, but maybe this prediction is really high. So I would say the Wakefield example is exactly why we need this.
Well, I think the larger question is the current system now, if chaos is applied around it, are there fundamental problems with it that will be exposed? And that, to me, is something that is always the surefire sign of good change. When a system is entrenched and then you provide – I mean, because look, this is going to be a journal. This is going to be a website. This mm-hmm. is going to be – you know, it might as well – for all intents and purposes, it might as well be a zine or a Tumblr, right? And so if stuff is out there, then it will only be of worth. The chaos will only be of worth if it provides counterexamples to things that are already understood to be solid fact, or it provides ideas or proof or, you know, evidence that things that we understand or are vetted by other more prestigious outlets might have, you know, might have to correct their findings or reproduce their findings. And if that's the only way that this matters, that this is a problem, then I think that that's okay. Well, otherwise, it'll just be ignored.
Let me give you another example. So we had a study came out, got published in Nature magazine about a month or two ago, and it was about the idea that the oceans were warming at a much dramatically more increased rate than we expected, right? They said, hey, these are it's warming way faster, made headlines around the world because, you know, I think we all think climate change is something we need to focus on, address attention to here, but this was saying, no, it's way worse, okay? Published in Nature, made its way around there, took a month or two half later, I don't know if they issued a full retraction, but the people who published the study said, wait, we think we got these tables wrong. We think we need to go look back at this. We may have way overestimated this, right? The reason that happened was a climate skeptic, I want to say it was McIntyre, had said, hey, looked at the tables, looked at the data, noticed they made a big error. Said, you guys made a big error. Published this, says, hey, look at this. And it was very clear they made an error in this. Not to say the oceans aren't warming, let's make this clear, but not at this dramatic rate that they said. Why did it take a climate skeptic, an outsider, not a guy part of a university, be the one to point this out? It made it all the way to Nature magazine. Nobody anywhere along the way said anything. Nobody within that department, nobody in none of the people reviewed it, none of the people who read it. It took some lone climate skeptic to say, hey, no, this is actually wrong. You need to fix this. That's part of the problem with the process. Is I can tell you my theory on why. It's because it's easier to say, yep, it's as worse than we thought, than it is to say, nope, it's not that bad, or maybe, you know, something else is going on there. All positions should be tested. So it took a climate skeptic to say that. How come, you know, this one outsider was the only person to be able to make it, you know, make that point?
So what would in this specific example, the existence of this journal do to ameliorate that?
If you're a person who is.
Oh, I guess your theory is along the way, people noticed, but they just didn't say anything because.
Might be, but they're because of the fear. Like if you say, hey, like, no, I think climate change is a real problem. I think this paper way over exaggerates the situation. We've had a number of people who've retreated from this, like Judith Curry, who was doing, I think, good research. People like her who just got out of it because, like, she's like, I can't correct these things or make notes of this without all of a sudden being attacked by all of my peers. I mean, Judith Curry's had a great reputation, but she said, hey, there's some problems, some major papers everybody else agreed with. And basically kind of just got, she just said she left academia of her choice, but there have a number of people there who, as far as their scientific reputation, I understand, were solid, but there are people saying, well, we need to apply this standard. And we look at this and that, you know, reflects bad.
Tally in the chat. And again, this is Tally's business. Like this is what she does, is academic research. Makes the point that peer review is often a label that is about as useful as gluten-free on a water bottle. Which, like, I think if you want to look at the worth of the relationships that academia has with these journals and the way that we understand a career progresses is, you know, there are certain names and they are vetted and they are respected and they're the ones who get their studies published, then that's a major issue. If somebody from inside the machine is like, hey, peer reviewing might not be quite as rigorous as it could be, like that's a problem.
And yeah, I think the person who's known in the field who maybe doesn't want their research overturned. You know, it also comes into like grant applications too. If you look at like National Science Foundation, the average age of people who've been awarded grants, it keeps getting higher and higher and higher, which means how they're selecting for stuff. And so, you know, it's the best system we have, but
look, the greatest moments of the internet, in my opinion, have been when large systems had very small chaos applied to them and they had to radically recalibrate how they thought about doing their business because there were you know, it just, I don't think it was necessarily, you know, maliciously done, but shortcuts were taken and the shortcuts worked and we just kind of kept moving along. And then the internet allowed the world to comment on everything, and be it something as small as somebody realizing that the font on a controversial memo from 60 Minutes could not have been produced on a typewriter at the time that it was supposed to be done, and instead was identical to Microsoft Word, or something even, you know, like this. I think we should not fear, anybody who is doing the proper work should not fear a little bit of chaos. You should understand this is the chaos that surrounds you. You should be able to build a boat that withstands these waves. So I understand the idea that, okay, well, this might be something that we can't control, and now it is outside this little system that we have set up. But if you can't handle this, then I don't know. That makes me more worried about the idea that it's like that this idea would be rejected out of hand.
Well, I mean, that's the goal, is to say, hey, if you think there may be repercussions for saying this, this is a forum that allows you to say this. And, you know, the when you say it in that forum, you lose the credibility that comes attached, you know, you lose the credibility of not being able to use your name. And like in a case like Wakefield, you don't get to say I'm from this hospital and all of that. So give it weight. And that was part of the problem, was is that he had so much credibility because of the background he came from, et cetera. But you know, things that appear in the Lancet are going to be treated much more seriously than this journal. But if you want to have a forum to say, hey, look at this, here's some research, take a look, make up your own mind, not have it have academic repercussions on you, I think it's a good idea.
Well, and also I think it can create a system within academia where the question is, you know, now you can have places that are like, all right, well, we're going to take this data and we're going to violently try to reproduce it. And we are not going to have our own ego to it. And if we do reproduce it, then we will get our name on it, and we will get the benefit from it. If we destroy it, then we will get the benefit of having destroyed it. I think that there is, the more we talk about it, the more I think that there is a tremendous value to getting ideas and evidence out anonymously, so you remove some of, again, like Brian said, you're double blinding. I mean, he mentioned the Crichton idea of double blinding the funding, but also, look, double blind, remove your own ego from these findings, and let's have a lot of these amazing minds focused on you know, destroying this evidence, and if they can't, then we got some. That's science, right? Like we should be trying for the failure, and when we can get the success, it's awesome.
So there we go.
Yeah, there we go. It's funny. The one thing that Tally says in the chat is that, you know, it reminds me, and she's describing the peer review system, much like I think a system that Andrew, as a author, goes through to get his book blurbed, where you just kind of send a manuscript along, and you know, you certainly hope that everybody who is giving you a really, really good quote reads it, but you're not going to their house, and you know, you're not making them write a book report. You're just happy that somebody writes a nice thing that you can put on the cover, right?
Yeah, and it's we have the ideal, you know, we because we like to say, like, you know, science system is self-correcting, which I believe, but I like to say, like, how do we know?
Yeah.
How do we know? How do we know? Have we known everything that's been corrected? You know, like in a long enough timeline, everything's self-correcting. You know, is it, you know, the rate at which it corrects?
I was going to say, here's something that self-corrects. Patreon.com/weirdthings. How about you head on over there right now? Yeah. You want to know what? Here's the thing. Guys, I know that this is a very big time of year. You know, everybody's buying stuff. It's Cyber Monday as we record this. However, I do want to let everybody know that every single dime that comes into the Weird Things Patreon is very, very, very much appreciated. And it keeps us creating this very show. So go ahead and head on over there right now. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
And I'm gonna point out that hey, another way to support the show is to support the contributors of the show. I know Scam Stuff has got a sale going on right now, some great stuff. I bought, just so you know, like, I legit bought the Houdini box thing. Yeah, not because like, oh, Brian's my buddy and I'm going to support. I'm not that guy. I'm like, this looks really cool. I want to have a cool thing I can set here and have people check this out. And if you've never been to Scam Stuff, go check out the cool stuff there.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I was speaking to David Rowan earlier today, and I think we're just going to hit a buzzer and extend the sale by another 24 hours. You know, normally it's like you got this kind of Black Friday to Cyber Monday thing.
Amazon gets a week. So.
Oh, do they? Yeah, okay. Well, so you got time. If you're just getting this, then head on over. Also, stickers with DIAF. Get that Night Attack loot and your politics shirts.
What if I really hated mayo? What if I really, really hated mayo?
You could get the Death to Mayo enamel pin. that one's actually selling really well. So is the Night Attack button set. We have the Jury and politics button set. And, of course, the biggest, most diverse sticker pack that we have ever offered, including going way back to the first orders that we ever made, original Spearmint Nitrate art. When that stuff is gone, man, it is over. So, head on over there right now, stickersordiaf.com, and use offer code BEES for free checkout.
Yeah, BEES. BEES. Always had to be the BEES. So stickersordiaf.com.
Yeah, stickersordiaf.com, because I didn't get around to the rebrand before the end of the year.
Yeah. We know our topic now for after things. So very cool. These guys are super, super creative, and they're creating cool stuff for you. For you, people. For you, you ungrateful people. Not all of you.
You can always go to Amazon.com and buy one of Andrew's fantastic books.
Don't worry about that.
I'm just saying. There's a lot of really good books out there. Just search Andrew Main.
You know what? Are you somebody who's read an Andrew Main book and enjoy it? Here's another idea. Why don't you give the gift? But you buy a book. And you write why you liked it in the cover, and you give it specifically to a person. And that is one of the most special. Some of my favorite book reading experiences have come that way, because there's something about sharing thoughts in your head that feels intimate and precious.
There was actually the first night I hung out with Brian. I left with, it wasn't physical books, but it was definitely audio. I think I left with like four like audiobooks on a thumb drive that. That Brian handed to me on my way out the door, which was amazing.
Gentlemen.
Yeah.
Get ready to panic in 3, 2, 1.
Oh my God.
The Chinese are creating CRISPR babies.
To the uninitiated, that could sound really bad. Instead, it's only mostly bad.
They keep them in that drawer with the lettuce.
they rotate them on a spit until they get crackling.
So CRISPR, as we've talked about before, is a gene editing technique that we actually stole from bacteria, which allows you to take precise genes and remove them. You can also swap them out. And there's another technique like that called Cas9. Which, you know, there's still some debate over the how effective these things are, whatever. Amazing techniques that have led us into like whole new areas of how to do specific gene targeting. Right now, in just about everywhere, including the U.S., like, we're very specific. Like, hey, don't do this on human embryos. Don't do this on this. You know, we fear the unknown. We don't want you to do this. And there was some early gene replacement therapy techniques that were completely disastrous because they were thought out. So anyhow, we're taking the precautionary principle, but not China. China has been like, hey, you know, listen, we could eradicate disease if we do this. How about that? Seems like a worthwhile cause. So China's been doing some, you know, more advanced, has been doing it on embryos. There's some controversy a while back because they seemed to like doing it at advanced stages. Now reports say, and again, it's the internet, it's shifting sands. You know, this is what we're hearing now, but it could change. According to Chinese medical documents posted online this month, a team of the Southern University of Science and Technology in Shenzhen has been recruiting couples in an effort to create the first gene-edited babies. They plan to eliminate a gene called CCR5 in hopes of rendering the offspring resistant to HIV, smallpox, and cholera.
Man, this is troubling. Not so much for like I'm not actually against the idea of genetically modifying babies, especially when it
comes
to
good news, Brian, because right now researchers are in the room with your children, ready to.
But the real problem to me is that you're not going to know if this works for what 30 years until you're able to do a large scale study of who. You know, was in high risk groups that didn't get HIV and compare that to a control group and all that stuff.
I think you could know within a year.
What, by intentionally exposing them to HIV, or
you can do smaller tests. You can do attenuated versions of these things. There are certain blood tests or other things like that you could do. So there are ways you could find out much.
Oh
much,
yeah,
much
I guess sooner. I guess so. Yeah, you take their blood and then you expose it, and then they
Or using attenuated versions of it so that they're, you know, non-lethal, but to see, does the body produce the antibodies and all that? So,
all right. So let's,
or let's be honest. It's China. Expose a bunch of kids to cholera. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, there's,
oh, sorry. They would never do that. I'm kidding.
I mean, that's the equivalent of somewhere in China.
It was a joke.
Somewhere in China, there's a Weird Things podcast where somebody said, like, I mean, it's America. Just give them some blankets infected with smallpox. Am I right?
No, you know? I don't mean like it's a good idea to do that. I mean, give the government's propensity for, hey, let's test it.
No, they certainly do.
Very, very clear. I am super pro the sanctity of every single Chinese person's life. I'm just fearful that there are researchers there that might decide, hey, they don't feel that I do.
China sometimes can march headlong into science and headlong into many things where certain safety measures are turned off.
And to be fair, not unlike our history of having done this on multiple occasions of things that we should not have, you know, unsuspecting people, whatever. Like, let me be very clear, you know, from the shooting, you know, bacteria at San Francisco and Oakland to see how it spreads to a little place called Tuskegee. There's numerous examples of us saying, you know, what harm could it do?
Yeah. Now, that being said, let's kind of pull back to the larger idea about gene editing. Brian, do you want to speak for the pro or con of gene editing? Because I think you guys probably have a better idea of it than
yeah,
I.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I'm not pro doing it irresponsibly, but to me, it seems utterly inevitable. Like, at some point, we're going to be so good at it in all of the critters that it will be a moral imperative to begin doing it on humans. There's no reality that I see 500 years from now us not doing that, because, and in fact, I could see demonizing parents that refuse to, where it's just like, you know, wait, so you're just going to let your kid develop this disease and die instantly upon childbirth, you know, shame on you.
So basically you're saying, like, based on our cultural attitudes toward vaccines, and let's ignore some of the, you know, stuff that your aunt posts on Facebook for 5 seconds. But, like, in general, society snapped to the idea that vaccines are a really, really cool thing on the large evolutionary timeline fairly fast. And this would be yet another example of, hey, we do want babies to live longer and healthier. We are constantly fighting against our environment and you know, the biome that both sustains and kills us. So right.
Likewise, let's say in as little as 10 years, we have demographic studies showing that, you know, massive diseases are being wiped out, and that Chinese kids are, you know, living or not dying. You know, that's the big thing is at first it's always to cure disease. And then you get into the ethically murkier territory of, well, are you getting it to cure a disease, or are you just improving and doing designer babies and all that stuff?
Are you getting it to be awesome?
But mm-hmm. Regardless, it definitely basically, I mean, yes, there might be something bad that comes of it, but it pays to be the ones to be first to develop and move forward. I mean, and then pretty soon another justification will be, well, they're already doing it and it's already working out very well for them. You know, we've got to play catch up and we got to get into a genetic arms race.
This is a story that got the kind of play on the Drudge Report this morning that is normally reserved for Matt Drudge's obsession with sex robots. So I know it's obviously something that has a big con side to it. Andrew, what would be the what are the warning signs that we need to think about when it comes to editing the genes of our babies.
So I'm overall like completely pro on this, like that clear. But like Brian, the you want to make sure it's not done irresponsibly, which, you know, and it's easy to go because part of me is like, well, obviously, but it's like, oh yeah, no, we do some of these things irresponsibly, and some of these smaller universities and research institutions are sometimes a little. We've had a lot of problems in this area because of some fraud, you know, of people with, you know, cloning research, things like this and other aspects of it. So that's problematic, but it's going to be problematic of any science. And those are just the things that we hear about. I'm pro. The dangers are this. my concern, I have a problem with some kinds of state-sponsored science. The reason comes from this. On one hand, it seems kind of like it's great, state-sponsored, it's for everybody, this is ideal. That is the ideal, but state-sponsored science often means the party in power-sponsored science. And, you know, we went through a period of time when the Republicans were in power, you know, nobody wanted to do, you know, even like fetal tissue research, things like this, things that could have been very promising. There was this, you know, that nobody wanted to do that. You know, when
stem cells was probably the biggest in recent history.
Now, as we've seen in Europe, when, you know, their version of the progressives are in power, we get anti-GMO. We get very, very big anti-genetically modified organisms. We get this thing sort of comes through, and it's no party gets to be the party of science, because I will go through and explain my point of view on each party's blind spot are the things they're against, which is problematic and disconcerting to me. So once I'm like, oh, we're the party, I'm like, no, this policy that, you know, is accepted by major people there may have killed millions of people here. Yeah, this policy may have prevented, you know, development of diseases. It could have saved millions. So state-sponsored science, generally, I kind of, you know, we just watch Mars InSight, which is amazing. But, and I could point to examples of how, like, yeah, once we have this big project, like these super collider projects, there's about 1,000 other physics projects that won't get funded because of this, or you have to tack, you know, you have to attach your project onto this, but these other promising areas don't get it because it's like, you know, it's like building, you know, a high speed rail train or a stadium. It's like, this is the only thing that gets funded, so we got to do that. The other problem comes into is when you get a single party system. Imagine if we had one political party that got to be in power here forever, and they got to choose this, you know, when they talk, you know, we start off, it starts off with like, hey, let's, you know, edit out, you know, these genes for disease, et cetera, things like this. Then, you know, we're getting into Brave New World. You know, we could get in, and that's the fear as we get into Brave New World. But I don't worry about Brave New World so much from independent research institutions. I worry about Brave New World from single party systems that know they're going to be in power for years and years and years. And that's my concern.
Yeah.
But they'll do it anyways, so it's irrelevant.
I mean, like, China definitely. I mean, just go ahead and look up the true love and romance story of the parents of Yao Ming, if you want to understand.
Yeah.
Basketball.
Oh, really? It was like an arranged marriage.
It was breeding.
Wow.
They bred a optimal basketball player and then garnished his wages throughout his entire career.
Yeah, the Soviet Union did the same thing with Olympic athletes. That was the thing, is they would pair up, incentivize people, high-performing people, to have children together. That's been the norm, and it predates, you know, those systems, but that's been, you know, any time where you have that much control over people, it's been a thing that they've encouraged to do. And what will happen with I think it's naive to assume that they won't try to do the same thing, you know, as with the new tools, the gene tools, things like this. And, you know, my concern is just that, you know, you have a country that's putting in place the social credit system, you know, the idea of there are certain traits they consider desirable. And we're a long way out from being able to, I think, reliably know how to do that in genes or to do this. But to think that that won't be something that's considered or even tried, I don't know.
Wild.
I'm all for this technology. I just want us to watch it closely and pay attention.
Yeah. Yo, you got picks?
We got some picks.
I got a pick, man. All right. There's this new show. Nobody's been talking about it, specifically on this show. You dullards fell into your blind spot. bodyguard. All right. Now, despite the fact that it sounds like everybody is calling each other mom.
Yes.
Yes.
This is man. It was really just a masterclass to me on what a suspense television is, and specifically different than you know, something like Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul or The Americans or something like that, where a lot of the suspense there is character based, right? These are characters that are making decisions and are complicating their own world constantly. And not to say that the characters are just pawns to be moved around on a chessboard in Bodyguard, but it's a different way of saying, like, we, our protagonist, from the moment we meet him, in one of the most awesome, like, opening 20 minutes of any show ever, I defy you. If you watch that first 20 minutes and then you're not in for the rest of the series, then that's cool. Check out. If that didn't appeal to you, then the rest won't, because it only gets more intense. It is about our protagonist, the world enveloping around him. And he obviously is very competent, but very complicated as things continue to get more and more thick. It is awesome. I loved a lot of the, let's say, soapier elements of it. They certainly start to pull out a lot of the, you know, any kind of trope about heightening tension that you possibly could as things get more and more, you know, things progress further and further. But I loved it, Mom.
So I still haven't watched more episodes of it just because I got pulled away into at the request of Tom Merritt and Bryce Castillo, little thing called Homecoming. Ooh. From the creator of Mr. Robot. As a matter of fact, the opening title sequence looks exactly like a Mr. Robot episode. I'm conflicted in how I feel about it, and I'm giving it the benefit of the doubt for a few more episodes because I suspect the story is very good when you start to figure out what's happening and you get more interesting questions, but it's beautiful, but the pacing is ponderous and it borders on the tedious in terms of keeping everything a wacky mystery. And also, I'm not impressed by the investigative abilities of our guy in the future, who, as best I could tell, agonizes after reading a few memos and placing 2 phone calls. Like, that's his whole investigation. But at any rate, I'm enjoying it enough. I feel good burning through it. I like that it's 30-minute episodes. That makes it a lot lighter. But unfortunately, it feels like they want to be hour-long episodes so that more happens in an episode. Each time one ends, I'm like, that's it? Huh. All right. And then go on to the next one.
That's my thing about Sam Esmail as a creator. Undeniably talented, and specifically visually, he is just somebody that is the, you know, to be understood as a force in the industry. But I think I said this about Mr. Robot, where early on, it's like either this is going to be the show that it was in the first season repeatedly, or it's going to disappear up its own butt, because his storytelling is very specific to how much he wants to reveal to you at any specific moment, to the point where, almost to the opposite of Bodyguard, where things are constantly being thrown at you, like, be they red herrings or you know, actual details. And even in boring moments when, like, somebody's walking to the store or to the bar, they just randomly play news clips that are leading you down one path or another, just constantly keeping your mind busy. Whereas with what Mr. Robot is, and what I can assume from the reviews of Homecoming, man, does he want you to luxuriate on the little morsels of information that you get one by one to kind of eventually crescendo in this very mannered way.
It definitely has kind of a bit of a lull in the middle part of the season when you realize, okay, clearly we are working our way to a turning point. But what happens, like, what the mystery is, like, what happened there and what do you do about it? And so I guess in that sense, it's not like a mile a minute, especially the way Bodyguard is. But I don't know, I had an easy time making it through Homecoming. But it's
how many episodes is it?
It's 10 half hours.
It's visually just a treat. The set design is extraordinary and the cinematography is great. And he doesn't do the very specific Mr. Robot tricks of, you know, ridiculous amount of headspace in the way he sets up the shots or anything.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit more conventional, but still just rich and luxurious from a visual standpoint.
I have a pick.
Yes.
I started watching this show over the weekend. I didn't get a chance to finish it, but it was also a really easy watch. It is the Sky/Netflix original Sick Note. It aired in England in 2017, and Netflix got both seasons of it pretty recently, I'm guessing. It's about a guy played by Rupert Grint, a.k.a. Ron Weasley, who gets diagnosed with esophageal cancer. And he's kind of a slacker, loser type guy, right? He works for an insurance company in England trying to sell people insurance. But he's not very good at the job, and he's in a bad way with his relationship with his girlfriend. And once he gets diagnosed with cancer, he tells people and people find out. And so his girlfriend stays with him to offer support, and the job that he's at is keeping him on because, you know, he's such an inspirational medical story. And then he finds out that the doctor messed up. He doesn't have cancer.
Oh, geez.
Because the doctor is also kind of a loser doctor, he doesn't want everyone to find out that he was misdiagnosed. So they both are playing this, like, tightrope game of, we're going to pretend you have cancer, and then we'll cure it in 6 months.
Oh, wild.
And it's good. The one thing about it that I don't love getting through the first season over the weekend was it's a good concept. There's a lot of things you could do with it, but it feels like a story where they did one thing with it. Do you know what I mean? Like, you could do a lot of, like, little wackety schmackety sort of stories about, you know, oh, faking I have cancer and you know, the two's company of trying to, you know, keep two different realities alive. But they kind of do one thing, and that sort of overshadows the larger concept, which is a little unfortunate. But I thought it was really funny, and it was a pretty easy watch. And because it's a British show, there's only like 13 episodes across both seasons. So it's pretty quick to watch. So,
and then they'll never do any more.
And they'll never do any more.
The same actors in the next 50 shows.
Also, Nick Frost is also in it. He plays the loser doc.
Oh, right on.
So,
of course he is, because he's Nick Frost and he's in everything Brit. That's like the great joy of all British television is that you will see everybody. Like, there is nothing funnier than the end of this of the show Extras, where Ricky Gervais's character, having, you know, had this hit, is shopping through agents, only to find out that all agents for British television stars can get you on EastEnders and Doctor Who.
Couple notes on Homecoming, just because it might be interesting to people to know. It wasn't created by Ismail.
Right.
Ismail's an EP on it. It's actually created by Eli Horowitz and Mika Bloomberg, and it was based on a podcast they created, which was kind of an interesting in of itself, that it was, you know, one of the first things we've seen of, you know, podcasts being made into television. And now when they did this with Gimlet Media, it starred Catherine Keener in the main role and had David Schwimmer and Oscar Isaac.
Yeah.
So kind of a cool thing. So there's a podcast already on a season two of the podcast, but just very, you know, we've talked, you know, this could be an after things discussion, but, you know, as far as what you can do with cool ideas and content, I think it's a very neat, I think Lore and there's some other ones, a lot of podcast stuff is being made into film and TV. So, but yeah, Sam is certainly bringing his visual style and all that to it, but I want to make sure we give credit to the writer here just wants to give credit to, you
and,
know.
And my understanding is that this adaptation is also written by the original writers of the podcast. It's not the exact same story, but it is written by them.
Yeah. Yeah. So kind of cool. My pick is, I thought it was fun, quirky. I enjoyed it. It was a little bit different. And that is, have any of you seen Ghost Stories starring Andy Nyman?
Mm-mm.
So Andy Nyman is a very interesting guy. He's a England from there. He's an actor and he's a magician. Andy Nyman was actually one of the people involved with like Objective Productions, David Blaine, all this. He started doing a live show where it was this sort of live sort of ghost story called, Ghost Story. And it was like this sort of scary sort of stories. And I think it came out the same time as the Teller Todd Robbins thing, but this was sort of was, you know, had its own, you know, really, really cool, you know, reviews as far as live thought, people who said all the live show and thought it was fantastic. Anyhow, he made it into a film and actually has Martin Freeman in it. And it's pretty cool. It's a really cool film. And I think you can watch it on, I think, Amazon Prime video. So anyhow, I watched that Ghost Stories. I thought it was a really fun sort of take. It features a story of a guy, debunker, of investigator of psychics and stuff, who gets presented with these three cases that, you know, his hero was never able to crack. Hmm. And then it.
And who stars in it?
Andy Nyman.
And Martin Freeman.
Martin Freeman,
because of course it's Martin Freeman.
Yep. Of course, yeah. Well, that's the only way we can get funding in England is the Martin Freeman, you know, financing act.
That's it. It's just everybody. They just, you know, it's like it's almost like one of those like Yahtzee. You just like throw them, like, and this British show is crap, and then some of them are just weighted heavier.
The thing I think about Martin Freeman is like. You remember when the actors worked on the original Lord of the Rings, it was like they just vanished off in New Zealand forever. Like, yeah. Martin Freeman never went away when he did The Hobbit. And I have a feeling that he's a guy that, like, you know, he gets home after, you know, long production on Black Panther. And he's like, oh, boy, I can't wait to take a bring, bring, bring. Hello, Martin here. Martin, we need you for this. What time? Cars being sent over right now. OK,
he's got that. Right. He's got that Michael Caine work as ethic. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, it's not even that he wants to do it. It's that his country needs
it. It's that the world needs him.
Yeah.
So check out Ghost Stories. That's my pick. So everybody good? Everybody good?
We're good. Yeah.
All right. It's been crispy. It's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.